Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to Reading Our Times, the podcast about books, about ideas, about us. In this series, we've been looking at playing God, science, religion, and the future of humanity, talking about scientific immortality, alien life, animal personhood, the rise in mental ill health, and the soul of AI. And underneath them all, the question that lies at the heart of Reading Our Times. How are we to understand our human condition? Many of the issues we've been talking about in this series, the soul of AI, the prospect of scientific immortality, the value of a life, our perception of mental health, the rights of animals, have gravitated to one big question, the question of personhood. What does it mean to be a person, to see a person, to know a person? So it is with particular pleasure that I'm able to conclude the series with a book that specifically asks that question. How do we know a person? The book is by the well-known author and New York Times columnist David Brooks, who's writing on character, on human relationships, and on the bohemian bourgeoisie, otherwise known as Bobos, has earned him respect on both sides of the Atlantic. His most recent book is entitled How to Know a Person, and is a guide, to quote its subtitle, on the art of seeing others deeply and being deeply seen. David, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here and an honour. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, many of the books that look at what ails us today are about 90% problem, followed by a quick 10% solution that's tacked on at the end. And one of the many delightful things about How to Know a Person is that you pretty much reverse that proportion and you spend most of your energy in helping us to establish better practices and ideas. But I do nonetheless want to start with the problem so at least we know what we're facing. Your chapter 8 is called An Epidemic of Blindness, and in it you say we're living in the middle of some kind of vast emotional, relational, and spiritual crisis. Unpack that crisis for us.
Yeah, I mean, something's happening to the relational fabric of our societies, and I know the statistics in the US the best, but the situation is no different in the UK or in France or in Australia or many other, especially Western nations and maybe beyond. But the number of people in the US who have committed suicide has risen by 40% since 2000. The number of people who say they have no close personal friends is up by four times since 2000. Depression rates are skyrocketing. Mental health problems are skyrocketing. The percentage of Americans who say no one knows me well is 54%. 45% of teenagers report being persistently hopeless and despondent. The number of Americans who rate themselves in the lowest happiness category is gone up by 50%. So there's just a breakdown in society that's making us sad.
Has this spiked? Is this something that's happened in the last 10 years, last 20 years, or has it been slow and incremental over the generations?
Take, for example, suicide rates. So suicide is pretty easy to count. It's not self-reported. It's an actual terrible act. And so suicide rates were going down in our societies through much of the 20th century, and then it begins to turn around 2000. And so right about that time, you begin to see a turnaround. And then I would say since 2013, you see all these trends accelerating. And so some of that is clearly the smartphone. And the suicide rates among teenagers has gone up astronomically. And so I think social media plays a role in this increase in relational breakdown. I think probably economic inequality plays a role. I think the decline of social capital plays a role. We're just less involved in civic and community life than we used to be. But the little piece that I focus on, and I think the only way to drive some sort of solution, is the breakdown in what you might call moral formation. And moral formation is a stuffy and pompous phrase, but it really means three things. One is, how do you help people restrain their natural selfishness? And two, how do you help people find an ideal, a purpose to give meaning to their life? And three, how do you teach people the skills they need to be considerate in the daily activities of life? And so my book really focuses on the third one. on how do you give people the skills to be considerate toward each other in the daily circumstance of life? How do you be a great conversationalist? How do you be a good listener? How do you disagree well? How do you break up with someone without crushing their heart? How do you offer criticism with care? How do you host a dinner party so everybody feels included? These are just basic social skills. They can be taught. They have to be taught. And somehow we're not teaching them. So my book is an attempt to walk people through the process of getting to know another human being and what skills you need.
And is it your belief that once upon a time we picked them up through osmosis? Not so much that we were formally formed in our characters, but the environments in which we found ourselves naturally formed those skills and characteristics. Would you say that's right?
I'd say that's half right. I think formerly more people went to church and they were involved in congregational life, so they learned how to deal with neighbors through that. People were more active in community organizations, as I say. Weirdly, I think the loss of extended families. If you're in an extended family of like 30 people, you got to deal with your crazy uncle or your crazy aunt. You just learn these skills. But I do think it's also true that schools and universities explicitly taught these skills. That until about after World War II, most people thought the primary purpose of schooling was to teach character skills. The Stowe School in Britain, the headmaster there said, "I seek to turn out students who are acceptable at a dance, invaluable at a shipwreck." And people who would show up for you in times of crisis. And they had things we would make fun of today. You know, they had courtesy clubs at schools, how to teach courtesy. They had thrift clubs. They had highly moralistic readings to bring moral exemplars before students. And so character formation was really the top thing. And then right about 1945, in my view, a new ethos settled upon our societies. The old ethos was human beings are wonderfully cooperative, but we're also deeply sinful. And if you're going to make a democracy out of sinful, selfish creatures like ourselves, you got to do formation. After World War II, a new ethos settled on society, which is people are basically good. We all have a little angel inside, and all we need to do is get in touch with our little angel to self-actualize. And so a lot of institutions like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts that were in the character formation business got into the self-actualization business. Get in touch with you. You do you. And so we just stopped doing moral formation because we thought people didn't need it. And it looks like that was wrong, but we still are kind of selfish and we need skills training.
That's fascinating. What prompted the change, do you think? And in particular, is it an internal change? So is this a kind of a shift in ideas about our inherent human characteristic, which then works its way out in other ways? Or is it simply the fact that actually, post the Second World War, we become a lot richer, we have far more resources, we find that we practically don't need to rely on one another, and therefore we don't?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think I would say all of the above. I mean, I do think that one of the advantages of becoming affluent is you can buy things instead of relying on relationships. So you no longer need your neighbor. You can just buy a servant. Or you no longer need, if you're a farmer, you know, you really do rely on your neighbors. You absolutely do. But if you're working as a lawyer, you don't rely on your neighbors as much. And so we can buy services that used to be done by neighbors. So I do think that's part of it. I think the big change was intellectual. And so you had the advent of psychology. There was a psychologist named Carl Rogers who was often forgotten today, but was considered the most influential psychologist of the 20th century. And his view was he was really the father of the self-esteem movement, that we just need to believe in ourselves. And his view was that the inner human being is good and people are always heading in the right direction. It's institutions that screw them up. And so we need to strip away all the institutional relations and just let each individual be themselves. And I think it was also flamed by what happened in World War II. In 1945, you had to explain what happened in the 20th century. Why did we have World War I and World War II? And some people double down on people are sinful and the crust of civilization is thin and we're prone to barbarism. And there was a theologian named Reinhold Niebuhr who believed in that. Other people argued that, no, the problem is authority. People are too willing to bow down to authority structures. And so we have to liberate people from authority structures and let them be themselves. And it produced this incredibly individualistic ethos, you do you. And you had individualism of the left, which was sort of lifestyle individualism. And you had individualism of the right, which was economic individualism. but it was all individualism all the way down.
Yes.
And so I think it made us, as Charles Taylor would say, buffered selves.
Yes.
We were just cut off more and more from the people around us, and we saw the loss of community, and finally the loss of skills that make community possible.
You don't go there in the book, but this seems to me to be Hobbes and Rousseau all over again, just 250 or so years later, a shift from a sense that human life is naturally solitary, poor, nasty, brutish and short, and as Hobbes had it, we had to impose authority then, to a century or so later, Rousseau saying, you know, we're naturally born free and idyllic, and it's the imposition of culture and institutions that are corrupting us. Historical ideas replaying in the 20th century, aren't they?
These debates are ongoing. And the other debate, I'd say, that goes back to the Enlightenment, is that in the Enlightenment, people had learned from the wars of religion, what lesson do we draw? And it's a little like, what lesson we draw from the 20th century? And some people in France mostly decided religion is bad, reason is good. And so we should trust, be as rational as possible. Other people in Scotland and Ireland primarily said, no, reason is not trustworthy. As David Hume said, reason is and ought to be slave to the passions. Our emotions, our passions, our sentiments are reliable. Our moral sentiments are reliable if we train them well. But the key instinct is if we train them well. And our emotions, our moral sentiments, what to admire, what not to admire, those are trained in families. Those are trained in neighborhoods. Those are trained in schools by the formation of habits. Mm. And so I think the Scottish Enlightenment has been completely vindicated by science. And the French Enlightenment has been not vindicated. It's been refuted. There's a great book called Descartes' Error about this error, believing that reason is separate from the emotions. And it's not true.
Mm. Now, absolutely critical word in all this, as one would guess from the title, really, is person. We've talked about moral formation. You talk quite early on about a culture of creeping dehumanization. But actually, it seems to me that the pivotal word in the book is person. And it is a depersonalization that I think is perhaps most pertinent here. What is a person?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. You're the first person on my book tour to ask me that question. And I also think it's pivotal. And I was teaching this book as a class at Yale for a couple of years, and I would ask my students, what is a person? And in all the times I asked that question, nobody had an answer. You would think it's kind of a fundamental thing, like, well, what is a person? And I would say a person is two things. And the first, and this will sound religious, but it can be and it cannot be, that a person is, first of all, a soul. Inside of each human being, there is some piece of them that has no size, weight, color, or shape, but gives them infinite value and dignity. That we're not equal in the level of brain power or muscle power, but we're equal in the level of our souls. And if you believe in God, you believe that soul was implanted by God himself. You believe that person was made in the image of God. But I think you have to recognize the dignity of each person, that there is some transcendent spiritual element, even if you're an atheist, that inside each person, so each person is not just a bunch of molecules. The second thing a person is a point of view. We take the experiences of our life and we build models in our head that help us perceive the world, that help us interpret the world, that help us decide what we really value. Aldous Huxley wrote that experience is not what happens to you, it's what you do with what happens to you. So we take all the pains we've endured, all the joys we've endured, all the books we've read, all the podcasts we've listened to, and we use them to complexify the models in our head. And those models are not only how we interpret the world, they literally determine what we see. It feels like perception is a process of taking in data, and then, like an old camera, the light flows into our eyes and it gets recorded on film. But that's not how perception works. Perception is a process of prediction and correction. You walk into a coffee shop and you think, what did I see the last time I was here? And you send out these predictions of what you expect to see, and your eyes check back and determine whether that's what you saw, and then they correct. And if you don't predict to see something, you will not see it. And the famous experiment that shows this is the gorilla experiment. I'm sure many people have seen it. You go on YouTube, and there's a video where they ask people to pass a basketball around, like five or six people are passing a basketball, and people are told to count the number of passes. And then after the video is played, the researchers ask the research subjects, did you see the gorilla? And they said, what are you talking about? I saw a basketball game. And they said, watch it again. And this time when they have the concept of gorilla planted in the brains, they see that a guy in a gorilla suit walked in the middle of the game, waved his arms, and walked off. They did not see it before because they did not predict it. We don't see with our eyes, we see with our whole life. Mm-hmm. And a person is a point of view. And if you want to understand a person, it's precisely that subjective layer you have to understand. It's not what happened to you, but how did you interpret what happened to you?
Yeah. You quote a good friend of mine and of the program, Ian McGilchrist, that he has made popular through his work, that attention seeing is a constructive and a creative exercise. It's not just a passive reception of what's going out in the world.
Yeah, and Neil Seth, a neuroscientist, who's also British, says perception is a controlled hallucination. We're creating a hallucination of the world that we are trying to control and make it accurate as possible.
Mm. One more question on personhood. That word person is quite closely associated with Roman Catholic theology, with personalism, with a brilliant Thomist philosopher, Jacques Maritain, who wrote a definitive book on humanism, and it was seized on by Pope Pius XII, I think, in the 1940s, and it's become central to Roman Catholic thought. There wasn't foreground in the book, but is that in the back of your mind when you're talking about personhood?
Yeah, very much so. So I really believe in personalism. There's a book by, I think his name is Emmanuel Mounier, called Personalism. And John Paul II was a personalist philosopher. And I think some of the philosophers that really informed the book, and in the background or in some cases in the foreground, I would include Simone Weil, who saw that attention is essentially the moral act. And she says the pure form of attention is prayer. And then Iris Murdoch, who learned a lot from Simone Weil. Mm-hmm. And Iris Murdoch argued that we tend to see the world in self-serving eyes. And our goal as humans to lead a decent life is to cast a just and loving attention on others. Mm-hmm. And so she emphasized, you know, male moral philosophers like Kant built these vast abstract moral systems that were designed to be logically impregnable. But to me, it's no accident that women, particularly Weil and Iris Murdoch, they were more aware of the local systems of care that govern day-to-day life.
Yep.
And a lot of the male philosophers were blind to those systems of care. And so Murdoch is very much a hero of mine for focusing attention on that morality is not always the big things. It's the way we greet people every second of every day.
Yep. And that's important to emphasize the breadth of that intellectual inheritance, because this isn't a narrowly religious idea at all. This is a humanistic idea in the truest and widest sense in the word, and it can draw from and it has influences from a range of different philosophical positions, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it does. And I would go back to the humanists of classical times, and then I would go, as I mentioned, the Scottish Enlightenment, the emphasis on the sentiments. But then you could go up to the current day. I mean, the late Roger Scruton, I think, had a lot to teach us on this. There's a woman in the U.S. named Margarita Mooney who writes on personalism. In the U.K., assume a friend of Theos is Luke Bretherton.
Yes.
I'm in the middle of his beautiful book on Christian ethics. But he has a concept of Christian humanism, that Jesus is the man. He is the image of the person. And that is the height of what it means to be a person. And so I think there's this rich vein of philosophy that has gone underdeveloped, in part because, frankly, some of the personalists like Maritain and Emmanuel Mounier, you read their prose and at some level it's beautiful. It's also extremely hard to understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
And I would share that. I don't want to pick on the Catholics. Martin Buber's I, Thou is really about the human encounter. It really is an example of personalism. But I've read that thing like 6 or 7 times and most of the time I can't pick up what he actually means.
Now, I want to pick up on those two definitions or descriptions of the person and draw out one particularly, I think, critical element of it. You talk about the person as soul. It is possible in our current intellectual climate to interpret both those in individualistic ways. In fact, sometimes people often use the word soul in a thoroughly individualistic way. But throughout the book, you're at absolute pains to emphasize that the person is an inherently, inalienably relational concept. And if we're talking about a point of view or talking about a soul, it makes no sense to do so in isolation from other points of view and other souls, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we're co-constituted. And so when a baby comes out of the womb, the first thing, its first desire before food is for a face to see. A first human need is recognition. And I'm sure some of your listeners have gone and seen these still face experiments where they tell a mother not to react to their baby's bids for attention. And so the moms just sit there still face. And if you watch the videos, within 10 seconds, the baby's in agony. They need recognition. We need recognition as much as we need food and water because we need to survive. And our ideas there's no such thing as thinking for yourself. The very language we think with is an inheritance from others.
Yes.
And so the simple example of telling your life story. Very few of us sit down and craft a story of our lives. We interpret the story of lives first when people ask us. And when you ask someone to tell them the story, you're giving them an occasion on which to actually begin to construct their story. But it's always done in dialogical form. And then we see ourselves the way others see us. Introspection is a very flawed technique. We just don't know what's going on in there. Mm-hmm. And when we seek what we call introspection, most of the time we're just telling ourselves fairy tales. Mm. But it's more accurate, and to know yourself is to know how other people know you. Mm. And your friends often have a better grip on who you are than you do. Mm. And so we mutually are co-constituting ourselves all the time. And that's why the attention is such a, as Ian McGilchrist says, such a beautiful moral act. When we see someone, when we shine the brightness of our attention on someone, we bring out different versions of them. If we see potential in someone, suddenly they'll see potential in themselves.
Yes. The other really important anthropological point to make in all this is how bodily this is. You say at one point the neurons in our bodies are contributing to some of the most important thinking we do. And there is this lovely little vignette about people who have Botox injections are themselves less able to perceive others' emotions because they're capacity to bodily react to the other has been limited. So as well as being inherently relational as persons, we are also absolutely embodied, aren't we?
I wrote a book about 12 years ago called The Social Animal, where I interviewed a lot of neuroscientists. And then I interviewed a lot of the same neuroscientists for this book in the last couple of years. And the two big shifts I noticed in neuroscience was they spent a lot less time trying to figure out where in the brain certain things happen. And they much more believe things are vast networks. But the more important shift is they spend a lot more time thinking about the body. The idea that the brain and the body are separate systems is not true. There are millions, hundreds of millions of neurons in the body. And what Lisa Feldman Barrett, a neuroscientist, said, the main job of the brain is to read the body and to assign a budget, to assign where we're going to send energy, which part of the body. And the brain is constantly looking at the body. Our emotions are all bodily states. And so you really have to acknowledge our mammalian existence. And so to be emotionally intelligent, you have to be able to recognize lots of different body states.
Yes.
And some people have low emotional granularity. They can't tell the difference between being depressed, which is a low state, and being anxious, which is an up state. They just have crude concepts in their heads. And then the final thing to say and how we influence each other, we underappreciate the sense of smell. Like, we're mammals. And so we're constantly smelling each other, not over Zoom or over a podcast, unfortunately, but it's a vital form of communication. I read somewhere that people who lose the sense of smell suffer greater emotional deterioration than people who lose the sense of hearing and sight, because we're constantly sending messages to each other through our noses.
Yes. I read some research recently about how when men shake hands, they unconsciously bring the hand with which they have shaken hands slightly closer to their nose in order to gain a sense of smell the person they've shaken hands with. Yeah. Now, I've not shaken hands with anyone after reading that research without thinking about what I'm doing.
It's all fist bumps now.
So we've talked about the situation we face, and we've talked about the impact it's having on our personhood. But as I said, a great deal of the book is focused on how we respond to that. And I want to talk about that and do so by picking up on two of the verbs in your title, knowing and seeing. Talking about knowing, first of all. Now, you repeat, I think, on a couple of occasions, a slightly gnomic, but I think quite profound statement that every epistemology becomes an ethic. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I got that from Parker Palmer, an educator in the States. And he says, every epistemology becomes an ethic. Our way of knowing becomes our way of being in the world. So if I know the world in an objective, detached way, I become a cold and detached person. If I know the world in a loving way, then I become a loving person. And one of the virtues of the Bible is that the word to know in biblical understanding encompasses a whole range of different activities, from rational understanding to studying to entering into covenant with to having sex with. It's a whole body experience. And so the Bible, frankly, like Chinese culture and many other cultures, doesn't make this distinction between reason and emotion, between cognition and what we ludicrously call the non-cognitive skills, but everything's cognitive. And so to know involves an emotional, a moral, spiritual, and intellectual embrace, not just an intellectual embrace. And if you want to know a rock, maybe you can study it coolly and objectively. If you want to know data about groups of people, then you can reduce things to data. But if you want to know one individual human being, data doesn't help you much.
Yeah.
And a cool, detached posture of a scientist doesn't help you much. You have to enter into a conversation with the person. You're not going to be able to guess the subjective reality of another human being. You have to talk to them about it.
I don't think you can possibly overemphasize the significance of that point, can you? The scientific epistemology, which has proved so very, very successful over the last 200 years, is predicated on a self-withholding, a removal of the self from the act of knowing. Whereas, as you say, any personal encounter has to be predicated on a sense of self-giving. And if the former epistemology eclipses the latter, we get into a situation where we share a society with people whom we can only ever know as objects.
Right, exactly. And I'm glad you made that point. And in some ways, it sounds like you and I both spend a lot of time reading academic studies, and they're useful. But there, some ways they can be blinding. So if I know the academic subjects on the study of American Republicans, and I learn that somebody is an American Republican, suddenly I think I know all sorts of things about them because I know what correlates with being an American Republican. And maybe across populations, that's more likely than not to be true, but it's not the way I get to see a person. You know, I heard about a lady who's a big Trump supporter. She's a lesbian biker who converted to Sufi Islam after surviving a plane crash. And so, like, what stereotype does she fit? And of all the books I've read of academic studies, set them on one side, and then set all the memoirs I've read by people describing their own life. Each memoir is way more interesting and more unpredictable than all the academic studies. And similarly, conversations with people, if you have good conversations, they're wildly unpredictable. And the generalizations we make about people rarely apply to the individuals right in front of us.
Mm. Another way that people think they know one another is through personality tests and personality traits. And you make the point that everybody knows the Myers-Briggs test, but it has vastly less validity than we think it does. And actually, a better way of at least beginning to grasp the variety of human personhood is with what we call five big traits: extroversion, conscientiousness, neuroticism, agreeableness, and openness. How useful do you think they are in helping us to know another person?
Yeah. I think they get you part of the way. It's like a template. It's very useful when you're studying a person to have certain concepts in your head. So if you're a sommelier and you like wine, you have a certain concept in your head, minerality or acidity, and you can use these concepts to identify what you're tasting. And so it's useful to have concepts in your head. And so, for example, if I meet someone who's super organized and super self-disciplined, they go to the gym every time they say they're going to go to the gym, then I've probably met somebody who's high in conscientiousness. And that's helpful for me to know it. They probably are going to do well at work. Conscientiousness correlates with doing well at work, doing well at school, being self-disciplined, being great at organizations. But you could be a conscientious nun or a conscientious Nazi. That trait doesn't determine who you are. And so, for example, one of the people I describe in the book as extreme extroversion is the former U.S. President George W. Bush. And when he was four, he'd go to Sunday school instead of politely greeting the teacher. He was like, "Hey, sexy lady, you're looking hot today." And like he was just like, and I've interviewed Bush a few times, and he erases social distance between people. But he also was probably a little low on openness to new experience. He wasn't a big reader before becoming president, though he tried to remedy that. He didn't have a lot of different theories in his head about different things. If you asked him about something, he would give you one answer and move on. And so there's a guy named Dan McAdams who theorizes that his high extroversion led him to the White House, but low curiosity led him to make the mistake of invading Iraq. Mm-hmm. And so having those concepts in your heads helps a little to understand. So it helps me have that concept. I'm going to know some of the traits, but I still have to check to see where the individual fits the traits and where the individual doesn't fit the traits.
Yeah, yeah. Because you're doing damage to their personhood by reducing them to traits. The traits may give you some indication of who they are, but they're not going to tell you who they are.
The trick is to have basic informed views of what human nature is, how humans tend to operate, and then apply those traits but not be slave to them.
Yeah. And let's look at this other very important verb, seeing one another. We've already talked a bit about seeing and how it is a creative process. You refer to perception as a generative act at one point in the book. And you also make quite a play of whether we can behave as a diminisher or an illuminator. Tell us about those two roles, those two behavioral traits.
At one point in the book, I say the subtitle is The Art of Seeing Others Deeply and Being Deeply Seen. But if I wanted to be more literal, it should have been I'm hearing others deeply and being deeply heard. Because most of getting to know a person is conversation, not like trying to see them and then imagine what's going on in their head. That does not work.
Yeah.
And so a diminisher is someone who's incurious about others, who's egotistical, he stereotypes, he ignores, he makes you feel unseen. And I found that I sometimes leave a party and I think, you know, that whole time, nobody asked me a question. And I've concluded that only about 30 or 40% of human beings are question askers. The rest are presenting themselves and they want to appear impressive, but they're just not questions. They're just not curious. An illuminator, on the other hand, is very curious about you, does have this knowledge of you, how humans operate, and makes you feel seen, heard, and lit up. The illuminator has the ability to get inside your head and see things a little from your own point of view. To really see someone, you have to see how they see the world. And so an example is E.M. Forster, the novelist who lived over a century ago, I guess. And his biographer wrote of him was to engage with him was to be seduced by an inverse charisma, a sense of being listened to with such intensity, you had to be your best, most honest, and sharpest self. And so that's just a great skill to have, that ability to listen that intently. And then there's a story, which is probably apocryphal, but which I tell in the book because it makes the point, about Jenny Jerome. And Jenny Jerome would later go on to become Winston Churchill's mother. But when she was a young woman in Victorian England, one night she was seated at a dinner party next to William Gladstone, the Prime Minister. And she left that dinner party thinking that Gladstone was the cleverest person in England. And then sometime later, she was at another dinner party and she happened to be seated next to Gladstone's great rival, Benjamin Disraeli. And she left that dinner thinking that she was the cleverest person in England. And so it's good to be Gladstone. It's better to be Disraeli, to make other people feel appreciated and brilliant.
Mm-hmm. There's one other question I want to ask before I draw our strands of our conversation together, and that's with regard to time. It strikes me that time is absolutely critical in this whole process. So much of this, knowing people, seeing them, hearing them, is about being patient. Yeah. And it's also about being present as well. It's making the time to be there. And you won't find a person today who doesn't somehow rather say that they're enormously time pressured and they've got to pack an awful lot into the day. It strikes me that that's one of the major tensions. Actually, we've got vastly more time than our ancestors did, if only because we live twice as long on average. Right. And yet we've convinced ourselves that our time is very, very precious and very, very limited. And therefore, we seem less inclined to have that patience and give that presence, which is central to building one another's personhood.
Yeah, I'm the worst. I when I pull into a gas station to fill up my tank with gas, a little thought always enters my mind, oh, you got 90 seconds while the gas is filling up. You can get two emails done.
Yeah.
And so that's a horrible efficiency mentality, and it's the enemy of the patience we need to get to know someone. First, we need patience because you can't really get to know someone. Like some of the questions I have in the book, it really requires trust and familiarity. And so like some of the questions to get to know somebody is like, what would you do if you weren't afraid? What role does fear play in your life? How do your ancestors show up in your life? How were you formed by your heritage? If this 5 years is a chapter, what's the chapter about? So these are somewhat revelatory questions. And you can't ask those questions until you've walked through the stages of building that trust. And so D.H. Lawrence has a beautiful quote I have in the book that you should approach a person the way you would approach a deer in the forest, with great patience, great gentleness, without an act of will. And we can't trust each other to have really serious conversations until we feel comfortable in the body. And then we have to be patient within the conversation. And I have friends in D.C. who say, we like our friends who are lingerable. That is to say, they're the sort of people who just linger after a party. And you never know where such a conversation is going to go. And I found one of the flaws I have, even after writing the book, you'd think I'd be like Dr. Freud, like be able to pierce people with my eyes. But I often don't pause a conversation when something important has just been said. And so somebody will say to me, confess some flaw or confess some dream they have. And I let the conversation rush on, but pausing the conversation at the crucial moments is like a skill. It takes a self-awareness. Mm-hmm. Oh, something important has just been said. Let's pause.
Well, that leads on to my concluding question, really. I mean, there's an awful lot of that we haven't talked about, not least some of the techniques. That sounds a bit too kind of technocratic a word, but some of the approaches that we can take to see, hear and know another person, and not fearing the pause is one of them. And you talk also about the importance of being a loud listener, of asking open-ended questions, of finding the disagreement that's actually under the apparent disagreement. There's lots there, and there's lots I haven't even mentioned in that list. What would you say was the single most important piece of advice, or the single thing that you have found most helpful in enabling you to see and hear and know other persons?
Let me put it this way. There's a psychologist at Northwestern University named Dan McAdams, and he studies how people narrate their life stories. And so he'll bring research subjects into his office, and he'll ask them, tell me your high points of your life, the low points of your life, the turning points of your life. And half the people cry. And at the end, which takes 4 hours, he hands them a check for their to compensate them for their time. And a significant chunk of people say, I can't take money for this. This has been one of the best afternoons of my life. And he has learned over time that people have never had the chance to tell their story. And if you respectfully give them the chance, they're thrilled, they're ecstatic, they love doing it. And so a lot of us walk through life, especially those of us who are more emotionally reserved or come from cultures that are more emotionally reserved, and I'm looking at you, Great Britain, that we think we'll be invading privacy. And so we don't ask, and we don't have these conversations, we don't go deep. We underestimate how much we'll enjoy even talking to strangers. We underestimate how quickly people want to go deep, and we underestimate how vitally important it is to our lives that we understand the people around us.
I have to say, from a personal point of view, that really does resonate. Many years ago, I used to work as a qualitative researcher, involved moderating focus groups, getting 8 strangers in a room, getting them to talk about whatever topic. And as you rightly say, being English strangers, they were kind of withdrawn into themselves. Sure. And so often, by the end of the 2-hour discussion, they would be saying, I really actually enjoyed this. I mean, I may happen to have been speaking about fabric conditioner commercials or whatever it was, but I really enjoyed connecting. If the group went well, I really enjoyed connecting with other people. It seems to me, even amongst the repressed English, there is this deep yearning to connect with other persons.
Right. Yeah, and an English friend of mine said, if you try to get to know us, we'll just tell a self-deprecating joke and move on. And so I think there's some accuracy to that generalization, but it just feels so great. And I will tell you, it feels great to be the one seeing another. There have been times when I've seen my wife, and I have a scene in the book where I'm looking at her, and I'm thinking, I'm not observing her, I'm not scrutinizing her, I'm just beholding her. Beholding is just an appreciative way of being aware of some person's whole flow of their being. And I mentioned this episode to some friends of mine who were older, and they said, yeah, that's what we do with our grandkids. We just behold them. And so it's just enormous joy to be able to behold someone and really feel I get the sense of who they are. Mm-hmm. I see the world. I'm seeing a little out from them. I'm not looking at them. I'm seeing the world through their eyes. Mm-hmm. And it's an intimate and powerful emotion.
The book is called How to Know a Person, The Art of Seeing Others Deeply and Being Deeply Seen. David Brooks, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and I'm really honored by the question. You asked me different questions than everybody else, so I'm thrilled to be able to talk on a more serious plane. Thank you so much for that.
Great. Thank you. You've been listening to the final episode in the series of Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. I want to express my thanks to all my guests this series: Andrew Davison, Stephen Cave, Eve Poole, Mark Rowlands, Abigail Schreier, Jenny Kleeman, and David Brooks. And also to my special guest interviewer, Chinny McDonald. I want to give a particular thanks to my brilliant producer, Phil Bodger, and Nina Humphreys for her wonderful theme music. And to the whole team at Theos, Daniel Turner, Fiona Hanscom and Chinny McDonald. And I want to thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the series, and I hope it's encouraged you to go out and buy and read some of the books we've been talking about. We'll be back for another series in the autumn, but until then, take care.